What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it. Okay, so this episode is about why marketing is not always your best growth lever. And why over investing in marketing actually doesn't work, especially if you are spending a lot / have limited resources and there are other parts of the business that maybe aren't as functional or as efficient as they could be. This topic is an interesting one because I do think it depends on the stage that you're in and what your goals are. And what I mean by that is if you don't have very big aspirational goals, and that's, I don't want that to sound like that's a bad thing. It is perfectly acceptable to run a lifestyle business. My business is a lifestyle business. Like, love it here. Want to really focus on, you know, building my craft, doing good work. And April Dunford always says, like, ride into the sunset. That's like...
That sounds nice.
Yeah, exactly. So there is no shame in running a lifestyle business. However, if you have very large aspirations, then the way that you think about growth levers does change. If you don't have very big aspirations.
Right.
If you're kind of just like...
Money.
Yeah, or money. Yeah, it could be that too. Although I will say in this economy, I know the VCs aren't necessarily like really dishing it out. But if you've got something, if you've got anything AI, I feel like they are, it's a little bit easy to get money, I feel like.
Right. And you have to move at the speed of lighting.
To Silicon Valley or something. Yeah. But yeah, like if you don't have very large aspirations, then the way that you think about growth levers does change. I think the other side to this too is the earlier you are, the more important customer acquisition is, because in those early stages, like if you're less than a million ARR, I mean, you're building the plane as you take off in a way. And that means figuring out customer acquisition, figuring out product, and figuring out activation like as soon as humanly possible. And all the other growth levers, pricing, expansion, a little bit of ops, a little bit of hiring. It just depends on how much budget or resources you have. But then there's also retention. Like you've got to figure out all of those things all at once. And in that period of time, it could be 1 year, it could be 3 years, it could be 5 years. In that period of time, there are a million things that could happen. But generally speaking, like customer acquisition is very pressing in those early days. And that I think is extremely true. Like, I don't think that that's untrue. Like, I think marketing as a growth lever in the early days, again, less than a million ARR. Yep, that makes sense to me. It doesn't matter if you tweak the product or tweak retention or whatever, like try to improve retention, I should say, or tweak pricing if you don't have customers. Like, none of that really matters. Customers are what matter and getting them. But I think, especially if you are PLG, once you cross over that 1 million ARR threshold, marketing isn't your best growth lever anymore, in my opinion. And the reason why is because marketing does not scale infinitely or fast unless the other growth levers change. So like unless you grow product, marketing has a ceiling. And I think the reality for most businesses too also is you can't infinitely spend on marketing. It just doesn't work. It really doesn't matter how much money you put towards marketing. This is, and honestly, like you can look at some of the biggest, shiniest, and flashiest examples in the VC world. Like you think about products like Theranos, you know, giant heaping mountain of fire. I'd say a different word, but you know, the YouTube algo and all that. But there are very clear, very public examples of you can dump as much like money as you want into marketing a product. At the end of the day, if it's not good, if it doesn't solve the problem, if people don't love it, if they don't stay, if they don't want to pay, none of that actually matters. Like at the end of the day, like all that money that you spent on marketing, set it, like just light it on fire, like, because that's basically the same thing that you're doing. And I think this is a really hard concept for especially first-time CEOs of SaaS companies, first-time founders and CEOs of SaaS companies. This is a really hard concept, I think, to kind of wrap your mind around, because it doesn't seem like it should be true, but it 100% is. Like, there are a couple of limiting factors that we'll talk about and like really break down, but once you cross over that million threshold, marketing becomes a player. It is not the captain of the team. And yeah, like, again, it's a really tough concept.
Yeah. And is this, so you mentioned first time founders, because this is different with SaaS, right? I mean, if it's a non-SaaS company, marketing could potentially be the biggest lever. But in a SaaS business, Possibly. There's just more levers, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. If you sell cereal and your cereal is cool, like marketing could actually be your greatest growth lever. Seriously. Like, and I think about, you know, brands that traditionally, like on its face, shouldn't be something that people care about, especially if it's commoditized. So think about anything that's commoditized out there. Wearable devices, for example, might not be like a true commodity. Like it's not like a good, like in that way, but it's there are so many wearables out there. There are like a bajillion wearables. Fitbit was one of the early ones. The Apple Watch is a big one, obviously. The Aura Ring is a big one. I wear Whoop, and that's, you know, one of my absolute favorite wearable devices. There are tons of wearables. What makes someone want one wearable versus another has to do with their jobs to be done, but I'd also argue it has a lot to do with their brand. Like, I think brand is a huge lever for something like this, where it's not going to appeal to everyone, but it is going to appeal to a very large chunk of a market. And I think, you know, any good or product, like physical, tangible good, I think a lot of it comes down to your marketing and brand experience and customer experience. Because a lot of, you know, we are, some would say we're in a post-capitalist society, but in our capitalistic society, there aren't that many new products, if you think about it. Like, a lot of it's like spin-offs of something else. And in order to keep people buying, you've got to appeal to something more than just the list of features that the device has or that the thing has or whatever. You think about like food or ingredients. Like, why do you choose that brand of spaghetti and not the other brand of spaghetti? Some buy based off of price, but others based off of, you know, when I was a kid, mom always used Ragu, and that's what I'm going to use because, you know, my feelings and my emotions, and this is like, this feels good for me to use. So yeah, like, and I think in other industries, yeah, brand marketing, sometimes your greatest and best possible growth lever. And in fact, something that I would argue is most critical. Ooh, I might piss off some people listening, but what's that Athletic Greens company? Was it A1 or AG1?
Oh, the one that just got recalled, a bunch of stuff recalled? Athletic Greens?
Athletic Greens. Yeah. I think it's AG1.
Okay. I could be mis-saying this. It was that one or a similar one that just had like salmonella outbreak, throwaway, if your lot number, this and this. Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly on the internets. In our opinions, let me just look it up. Because now I'm curious. AG1 News? Okay. I don't see any... Ooh, Peter Attia faces backlash over comments. Yeah. I don't know. I don't see anything about a recall. Well, I guess I didn't type in recall. Maybe they're just doing a really good job of not having it in the press. Yeah. I don't know if it was that one. However.
Oh, Live It Up. It was Live It Up. Super Greens. So not that one.
Oh, crazy. I used to buy Live It Up back in the day.
Super
Okay, well, now I'm going to throw my bag away.
I've actually bought one of them and I just didn't even eat it or didn't use it. I didn't like it.
Yeah, I didn't use it.
Yeah.
Man. So
that was it.
Well, I was going to say, like, AG1 is a prime example of marketing and brand overpowering, like, it, like that being the greatest possible growth lever. Because if you look at the product, there are no studies or science that says that this specific blend of greens is any better for you than any other blend of greens, or and or that these blends of greens have any real impact. And a lot of it potentially, allegedly, might be placebo. And also a lot of, I have not seen any studies about this because I haven't dug super deep into it myself. But there's a lot of research that suggests that maybe these like super green powders aren't actually like that helpful, but they are helpful in that in like a placebo effect type of way, they naturally encourage you to eat healthier, drink more water, like, you know, do all the things that you're supposed to do anyway. And depending on how much like vitamin content they have, they don't have as much as like a true vitamin would have, like a vitamin supplement. But again, vibes, like maybe the vibes are actually what you're really paying for. And also like it makes you feel better and yada, yada, yada. So what I think is really interesting, though, is like AG1, I think, is a great example of marketing and brand being like the number one growth lever. Like the product is potentially not that differentiated. However, the way that you feel when you buy it, that's what people are really buying. And I think so that other businesses or other industries or even like product types, marketing and brand can absolutely like be your greatest growth lever. I think we see a blend of that in SaaS, but when we think about anything that's recurring or subscription-based, so e-commerce, for example, has, there are plenty of subscription-based brands. It's not software, but they are subscription-based in that like they need people to stay and retain. And what makes subscription-based really tough, that like outside of software, is what is actually the perceived value over time? Because the law of diminishing returns does pop up more, I think, in like non-software scenarios. So for example, if you have a subscription to, you know, powdered super greens, what is the actual continued impact? And is that trade-off worth paying for? And with software, what's cool about software is, and the implication is that as a user, you are getting continued value and sustained value over time, and hopefully for a much longer time. Now, with all things, things change. So if there's anything that's certain in life, it's going to be that things will change. So what makes subscription-based for SaaS, what makes SaaS, I think, interesting is that the assumption is that there will be sustained value over time. And your goal as founder CEO is to optimize that as much as possible. Like, how do you ensure that there is sustained continued value over time? Otherwise, you get churn. And I think this is kind of where we cross over into, after you kind of get through like the SaaS black hole, put that in finger quotes, because I actually do have an episode on this. I call it the SaaS black hole, but it's basically like the black box that you go into that from the moment that your MVP is ready, finger quotes, to you are now getting your first 10 customers, your first 50 customers, your first 100 customers. And then from that point to getting to a million ARR, the black box is like that sub 100 customer mark. And then after you get out of the black box, now it's, okay, how do I really focus on getting customers and keeping them? Like that's the most important thing up until about a million. And then once you get to a million, usually like the business stabilizes a little bit and usually you're like able to breathe and you're like, okay, now what? And this is where I think a lot of founders are tempted to just kind of stay like, oh, well, this was working before. Let's continue to just focus on marketing. Mm-hmm. But what we find is that it's just not as efficient as if you were to look at other areas of the business. And this is where, as founder CEO, you go from, I want you to imagine like you're in the boiler room of like a cruise ship or something, and you're like shoveling coal into this, pulling this lever, turning this crank, you know, that's you. And like up until like the first million. And then by the time that you get to the first million, now you're in the captain's deck. And now you're at the top and you're like, okay, where do I steer this ship? And hopefully by now you've got people helping you, like, you know, fill the boiler room, you know, help customers, whatever, your cruise ship. What do they call them? There's a word for, you know, the people that you are taken care of on, like, while they are on your ship. And hopefully they enjoy their time so much that they don't want to leave for a while. But eventually things change and maybe they're like, I want to try a different ship. Like, maybe you were Carnival Cruise for a long time and you're like, I'm going to try, like a princess cruise or like a celebrity cruise or like, you know, let's try something else. So anyway, that's the metaphor I'm going to use and I'm going to stick to it. But at some point, though, you do have to make the transition from like you're in the boiler room shoveling coal, turning cranks, turning wheels, you know, sweating real crazy and hard and like running between all the different stations to, okay, now I'm in the captain's deck. Now what? Some founders, I think, get stuck in the boiler room. Like they never make it out. They never make it out of the like hustle kind of space. And my business coach, Charlie, talks about it like founder mojo. That's really what like the company in the beginning stages, like it's operating off of founder mojo and vibes. Like that's a lot of what it is. It's just like, okay, you're doing what your intuition is telling you to do. And that's what you should do. It's a very highly intuitive phase that you're in. And like what your gut instinct says about like what to do, what to build, where to go, and you informing your model, so to speak, of how you make decisions. Like all of that is happening in the first few phases and stages. But again, once you get to that place where it's like, okay, things are stabilizing a little bit, now let's get to the captain's deck. And now you're working on your business. You might still be working in your business. And I don't know that you ever... I think you do eventually move into working on your business, but I think that's maybe closer to like 5 million, 10 million ARR. Like that's where you're really starting to be more like, it's not necessarily up to you to do everything because you've got a team. Like you're able to afford a team. However, yeah, like there has to be like that transition moment. And when that happens, you almost have to like look at the boiler room as like, okay, there are parts of a system here. And it's not just going to be the one thing. It's going to be several things to make the ship go in the direction that we want and also to provide the experience that we want. Like you have to have crew. You have to have staff. There are people in the kitchens. There are people, you know, cleaning the aisles, swabbing the deck, like making sure like everything is, you know, efficient, timely, all the things, provides the experience to the customer that you want them to have, to your passengers, so to speak. That's the metaphor that I really want people to think about. And when it comes to marketing customer acquisition, we just find that it's just not like you shoveling more coal in the boiler room certainly will make you go faster, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to end up at the destination that you want, especially if no one's driving the wheel. Like, especially if no one's like thinking about, okay, well, that's great, we can put all of our resources here, but your passengers are like on the Lido deck, like, where's the entertainment? Like, great, but what am I here for again? And then they're looking at the other ship across the way and they're like, man, they look like they're having a lot of fun. And like, we're not, I don't know. So that's kind of the way I think about it. And I'll just wrap up and say the like marketing as a growth lever, I mean, it's going to be the most critical in the beginning, but you will get to a place where it's not necessarily the most critical all the time. And actually there are other growth levers now that have popped up. And if they don't get the attention that they need, you're not going to run a very efficient business. It's not going to be a very efficient experience. And you may find that the longer you neglect the other areas, the more it confuses customers and it confuses the market.
So I like this. And I'm curious your thoughts on where the founder does kind of spend their energy. Especially if there's multiple levers to be pulling and they're wondering where their time should be spent.
Totally. It does go a little bit into like how to think about troubleshooting growth or at least how to think about maximizing growth. So maybe growth isn't slow, but maybe you would like to maximize your opportunity or your potential. If growth is slow, that to me says we have ignored levers for too long. So if you're like growing at a snail's pace, again, that is, there likely are other growth levers that we just haven't really paid attention to, or we're doing them, but we're not doing them very well. On the flip side, maybe you are growing fairly decently. And if you're in that seat, you know, the other seat is, you know, you're pushing a boulder up a mountain and then growth feels really hard. That means that, again, like we've ignored certain things or just didn't know. The other scenario is you're guiding the boulder down the mountain. It's going on its own and you just need to make sure it doesn't crush anybody and it doesn't fall off the mountain. Like, that's your whole mission. You're guiding the boulder down the mountain and you want to make sure it lands where you want it to land, but it doesn't like destroy like a small village or something. So that's like your mission in that way. With the other growth levers though, so customer acquisition is one. We traditionally think of that as marketing and sales. The others include, and you've heard probably me talk about this on this podcast before, but there's going to be activation. So that's okay. You have convinced people to buy tickets to your cruise ship. Now that they're on the cruise ship, how do you get them to take advantage of all the really cool things that you're going to offer them to give them the experience that they want? It's not what you offer. Now, this is what I really want to make sure that's clear for people who aren't clear about activation. Product is ultimately what you're offering. Activation is the process of them experiencing the product, getting the value to start. And retention is keeping them. So if we use the cruise ship analogy, maybe you have a theater. Maybe you have comedy shows. Maybe you've got a casino. Maybe you've got an all-inclusive bar or whatever. It's not like that's product. Like, that's what you're offering. How do you get people to go to the bar? How do you get people to go to the show? How do you get people to go to see like the comedian that you brought on the ship for a night or two? That's like a special guest or whatever. Like, how do you get them to actually do it? And it's not enough to just be like, okay, great, you got your ticket. Bye. See you in a week when we all, disembark or whatever. When we all deboard, I think is what they call it. So that's what activation actually is. And then retention is about keeping them. So like, they want to come back on your ship or they want to stay on your ship. Because, there are some people who just like live on cruise ships. That's like all they do. But how do you get them to like stay? And so you've got to ensure like they activate and you've got to ensure that they get the value, that it's in alignment with them and that it's so great. They want to keep doing it and do it again. That's activation and it's retention. Monetization is pricing. So that's what we've charged them to gain access to our product. There's expansion. So once they've paid, if they would like more value and that is in alignment with them, how do we get them to pay more? You can't force everyone to pay more, but it's something where based on that person's needs, do their needs grow over time? And if so, how do we make sure to meet those needs and potentially pay more for them? And then there are a few other levers that the customer feels both directly and indirectly, but you may not think of them as like real growth levers. So there's customer acquisition, there's getting people, in the product, activating them, making sure that they achieve value fast and within the product. Keeping them, retention. What are we charging them? Monetization. How do we expand that value? That's expansion. And then there are a couple of others. So there are operations. How do we as a business deliver value to our customers while also ensuring that we are staying afloat? Like, how do we do both? That's ops. So like, what are the processes that we use? How do we... It goes all the way down to like, what meetings are we running and how do we run the meetings, to how do we work together as a team? How do marketing, product, sales, customer success, engineering, support, how do all of those functions work together? And then who makes decisions? How do we make decisions? Who's responsible for what? All of that's ops. And then there's people. Who do we have doing these things to help us deliver the value to our customers? There's hiring, culture, like all of those things go into thinking about, again, it's a value delivery mechanism. So there are, five growth levers that are SaaS PLG specific.
Yep.
There are two more, right? Five? Yeah. Acquisition, activation, yep. Retention, expansion, monetization. Yeah, five. And then there are two others, operations, people.
Yep.
So those are the seven in the business. And this is where, again, you go from boiler room to captain's deck. So like, your job now is, okay, I can see all the levers, which ones are on fire. And if they're not on fire, what do we need to do? Like, which one do we pull to expand and grow? Like the thing that we want to do. Sometimes when you're in the captain's deck, sometimes you look out and you're like, oh, activation is on fire. Like, this isn't converting as well as it should. We know that for a fact. This isn't working. It's making everything else inefficient. And it's a really clear, like, oh shit, we gotta go and fix that. But sometimes you're in the captain's deck and you're like, nothing's really on fire. And you have to ask yourself two questions. Is that because you just don't know? Or is it because it's true? And it's really more about, okay, if you were to unlock any one of these, what would that be to give you the greatest possible, you know, outcome? Or the, like, what would help you move the needle the most? So those are the two scenarios that it could be. And the best way to understand that, honestly, is through hiring and working with like experienced people. So it's either a consultant, it could be someone like us. It could be asking your own internal leadership. It could be asking a mentor or an advisor and helping you kind of suss out and understand. It could also be through your own education. So there are plenty of resources and materials, you know, as CEO and founder, especially if you're first time, part of your job is to learn as much as possible. And it certainly could be that as you learn more, you realize like, oh, you know, at first I was in the captain's deck and none of this seemed like it was on fire. But now that I'm learning more, actually, like, we don't have the right people on deck. Or actually, our retention could be better. Like, our monthly churn is fine, but maybe net revenue retention isn't great. So that's really the process that we're going through, especially as we're in the captain's deck. But what I will say is that's impossible to do if you are still in the boiler room. Like, you can't do that if you're in the boiler room because you don't even see the Lido deck. You don't even see really the cruisers and the rest of the crew and all that because you're so focused on putting out fires down below that you don't have the bandwidth or the capacity to do that. So if you, and you may be in a scenario where you aren't able to do that yet, but if you are, like if you're more than a million and you're still in the boiler room, like we gotta rethink some things because there's a good chance that there are tasks and jobs that you're doing that could be someone else's responsibility and get you back in like the captain's deck, like in that seat so that you can oversee the whole thing and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. How do you know if you're too, because I mean, we've talked to a lot of founders who are still doing quite a lot, but they still like for the bit, you know, in the boiler room. But they still can see maybe we need to think about pricing. Like we haven't visited that since the start of the business or, you know, we could probably improve our activation rates. So like, can there still be a little bit of both? Like how do you know at what point are you really too far in where you can't see everything?
Yeah. I look at this more, I think that there are financial signs. I also think that there are like internal signs, personal signs, things that, you know, only you can know your thoughts, but I do see it come up sometimes in conversation with founders. So let's talk about the financial indicators. I think you can definitely tell when maybe it's time to start like replacing yourself on certain things based on how much profit like you're raking in, honestly. What we typically see is founders will get to this like they're close to a million, but they're not quite there. But it's still like them doing everything, and they're really not paying. Like they're taking a healthy salary for themselves. But what we find is sometimes like that's not even true. Like sometimes like they're not even like paying themselves like enough. But what's especially true is they're making enough profit that actually they could take that profit and reinvest it into the business, and like relieve themselves of a lot of stress. Like there are financial realities that make that possible. And I don't typically get into the finances of a SaaS business, but when I do, usually like that's the number one indicator. It's like, oh, you're very profitable. You're super profitable, but like you could take this profit and eliminate this roll off of your plate, hire this person and like maybe like buy like these two or three platforms or whatever. Or like hire these five people. Like I've seen that before too. Where it's like actually like you could literally hire like a suite of people, like a team of people if you wanted. But for some reason you're not. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get into internal signs. So internal indicators, and again, this is more like this is what's going on for you personally, but I can always tell that it, you know, we, at the end of the day, like, you can't make anyone go from the boiler room to the captain's deck. You can't force anyone to do that. Like, that has to be something that you desire to do and that you feel good about doing. But what I find is what typically prevents founders here is fear of success. What if it actually works? Sometimes it's also fear of failure. Maybe they don't think of themselves as a CEO. They don't think that they're going to be a good CEO. Like, there's a lot of things that can go into this. But there's something about their context that doesn't make them feel like they can go further. And sometimes it's just fear of the unknown. They've never done that before. They don't know what it looks like. It's really comfy, cozy being the lead developer, being the lead product person, because that's what they've known their whole lives. And also possibly no real desire to do that. And I think, like, if that's you, if you're bootstrapped and you're profitable, like, do you? Like, I think I've said that several times, like, on the pod, like, you know, you don't have to grow if you don't want to and if it doesn't serve you. But if it is something that you want to do, if it's something that you, it's like one of your greatest heart's desires, one of the things that you have to get really good at is as someone becoming CEO. Like, if you're a founder transitioning into that CEO role where you're like, now, like, you're in the captain's deck and you're in the seat and you're like, you're there. Something that you have to do is get really good at being self-aware of what are you avoiding and why? But then also, what are you afraid of? What's giving you anxiety or pause? Like, all those things. And there are a number of incredible, like founder psychologists out there, like people who specialize, like, they're psychologists and they specialize in entrepreneurs and, you know, business owners. I don't know actually if she's still practicing, but someone I really respect in this space is Dr. Sherry Walling, mm-hmm. Rob Walling's wife, Sherry, who's really freaking awesome. She creates products and resources for founders doing this exact type of, like, exploratory work. And it's necessary. Like, I think it's really tough to be a good leader without being self-aware. I think it's really easy to be a very bad leader and super not be self-aware. Uh-huh. But the hard work is being self-aware. That, to me, is what's hard. So I think I do believe that a lot of what prevents people from making that transition is their lack of self-awareness and also their lack of honesty of just, like, what do you really want? I think, you know, and we've talked about this on the podcast too before, but sometimes we've worked with founders in the past who maybe thought that they wanted to grow and then they hire us and then they're like, oh, this is hard. It's a lot of work. I don't know if I want to. And we're like, that's right. Fair. That is totally fair. You by no means have to grow. It's not a requirement, especially if you're profitable and especially if you're happy, like, doing exactly what you're doing. But I will say, though, like it really, I think, has to be a desire. I also do think it has to, it does ultimately come down to, like, your own level of self-awareness and your own, like, honesty about, like, what you really most want and also what you're willing to make trade-offs for, because growing a business isn't easy. It's not for everyone. And it's definitely not, like, a walk in the park. I think there are things that make it easier and more manageable and more palatable and definitely faster. There are very inefficient ways to grow. We are obviously proponents of efficiency. So all that to say, I think that's kind of what it looks like, but I do think it's more personal. At least that's what I've seen. There are definitely financial indicators. Like, you could absolutely afford to hire someone. I think it's more about desire and, you know, and also just mindset. Is that where you want to go? Does it make sense for you? And if all of those boxes are checked, yes, then it's like, okay, well, now you have to get out of your own way. And that's probably a different, you know, podcast topic.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess just worth mentioning, and we can link to it. We did have an episode where we talked specifically about the people lever.
Move
deeper into that. Because a lot of people don't consider it as a growth lever.
Yeah, they don't. You know, I am not a business coach, like, in the, you know, like, I guess technically I am a business coach, but it's more on the like operational, like, implementation side of the business. There are, like, executive coaches and, like, business leadership mindset coaches. That's really what I'm thinking of. Like, my business coach, for example. And there's an interesting phenomenon, I think, that happens like as you start to hire your first either employees or contributors. They could be contractors, freelancers, whatever. There is something about your brain chemistry that changes, especially if it's something that you're averse to. I think part of why it is so underestimated is because I think that there's a very widespread belief, especially in SaaS, that you can't hire good talent that you can afford. And that you'll, and I do think, like, to some degree, that is true. I think some of the best, most talented people out there, they are charging what they're worth. It's well into the six figures. And a lot of, like, early stage bootstrap companies won't be able to afford that immediately. But could they afford maybe an ongoing consultant or advisor and then maybe a more junior team? Definitely. And I think, again, like, your brain chemistry changes when you start to hire people. And I think for the better, you start to see that there are more ways to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And I speak that from experience, because for the longest time in my business, I didn't think I could hire anyone. I didn't think I made enough. And I definitely didn't think I could bring on anyone full-time. Not bringing on full-time employees was more of a choice for me. I chose to really work more with, like, other consultants, contractors, freelancers, et cetera, because to some degree, it's correct. Like, I couldn't have afforded to bring on, you know, like, a six-figure person, like, in my business full-time, at least, as, like, an employee. But what was very clear to me, and it took a while to get here, was I deserve to resource myself, though, because I don't have infinite bandwidth, I don't have infinite energy, and I definitely don't have infinite attention span. So if you're a founder out there and you've got ADHD or whatever, very strong chance that you do. I just knew I couldn't do it all, and I was going to burn myself out. And now I've got health problems because, you know, like, my adrenals are shot or whatever. I'm fine. But, like, that's the path, right? Like, you go super hard for a long time in your 20s and you burn out, and then you get middle age and you're like, oh my God, what do I do with my life? And then you're just like, I just want, like, peace and roses, like, all the time now. I don't even care. But yeah, no, I think it's a mindset thing. And I think it really does change your brain a little bit when you think about how to resource. And I think so much of the challenge is probably more that people just don't know how to resource effectively, which is part of why, spoilers, Kim started demand recruiting. But yeah, like, there are so many, I think, mental blockers there. But I think the more that founders and CEOs talk about how they staff and resource in the early days, and then as they grow into more, like, established teams, I think that helps others kind of see, like, oh, I have other options. Like, maybe don't hire the full-time person in the US. Maybe look at, like, South America or Eastern Europe. Like, there are other places to hire resources. And it doesn't have to be full-time. It can be contractor. It can be freelance. And it can be very experienced. And maybe you can also split the expertise. Like, maybe you spend a little bit on a retainer, like, on a small advisory retainer with, like, a super experienced person, but maybe your team is a little bit more junior, and, like, that, I mean, that has its own trade-offs, but there are ways to get what you need that won't cost a fortune. Yeah. And will help you make progress. But I just think there are so many out there who just don't know how to make progress because they just don't know what their options are.
Right.
And, you know, again, and part of it too could just be desire. Like, maybe they don't want to. Well, that's fine.
Right. But and if they do want to. Hard.
You know, then you have to think, yeah, okay, now hard. You got to still put in the work. So it's a different type of work.
Right. It's a very different type of work. It's a different skill set. It, you know, depends on your ability to understand, like, what you most need, get really clear on what you can afford, and identify that in others. Like, that's a very, it's a interesting skill set to have. But once you have it, it's a muscle that you're going to build eventually over time. And once you have it, it's going to be incredibly worth the time and energy to do.
Yeah.
I think the only topic we didn't cover was why overinvesting in marketing doesn't work. So overinvesting in marketing doesn't work, and largely because, these are the limiting factors I was going to mention earlier. Part of why this doesn't work, there are a few reasons, but the first, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, but the first is that the market never moves as fast as you move. The market is actually very slow. And I'm putting the market in these, like, finger quotes because, you know, the market is this, it's like ethereal, intangible, magical thing that you only ever really see when you talk to customers, go to events. Like, that's the market. But the market moves in almost this like spiritual way. But the thing about the market is that it doesn't move as fast as you do. And just because you dump a million into ads, billboards, whatever, mail packages, certainly will help, but it doesn't mean that people will buy and adopt like as fast as you're putting it out there. So overinvesting in marketing, I find, does not net out the same result. And what I typically find, especially for companies like, again, at that 1 million to like 4 or even 5 million mark, what I typically find is like the more they spend on marketing, the more that they're just kind of burning resources. Like, it doesn't actually make things go faster. I find that is only true. There are certainly, you know, scenarios that break the rule where like maybe marketing was on fire for a long time. Like, maybe customer acquisition was on fire for a long time and you finally decided to invest in it. But if it's not actively on fire, investing more probably isn't going to get you what you want. Like, you have to start looking at in other places. So that's the first, is the market just doesn't move as fast as you do. The second is that there are absolutely diminishing returns in most channels. So for example, marketing is a practice where you have to make sure that you're showing up at the place that your audience is. Tactically, what that looks like, it could look like buying ads, sending emails, building your list. If you're doing outbound sales, cold calling, then there are things like hosting events, attending events, you know, sponsoring podcasts, sponsoring or creating like your own YouTube channel or whatever, publishing more. And literally all of those things have diminishing returns, like every single one. Sending more emails doesn't necessarily get you more customers unless it's to more indifferent customers. But your market is relatively limited, again, based on product. So your product is only going to be applicable to so many people. So there's TAM, SAM, and SOM. There's total addressable market. That's like all the people that you could possibly sell to ever. That's the ethereal, like, magical number that we don't really know. There's service addressable market. These are people who could use your product out of the TAM. That is actually a little bit more applied and direct. Serviceable operable market, SOM. That is people who can literally use the product right now. And that's like a fraction. TAM is big, SAM smaller, and then SOM is like only 5% of the market is actually ready to buy like right now. And like a little bit more than that is like who can actually buy, like who actually is in the place where they could buy like right now. So that law alone basically says, okay, there are only so many people who can literally buy right now. And all of these channels have diminishing returns the more that you do them. So running more ads doesn't necessarily work. Running more ads to the same group of people definitely doesn't work. Sending more emails to the same group of people definitely doesn't work. So the only real option that you have is to continue to expand your SOM. But SOM can't expand unless product expands. And that's why overinvesting in marketing, it doesn't actually make sense if you think about it. Where it does make sense, again, is if marketing is on fire, customer acquisition is on fire, and that's like a clear lever to address. So yes, investing in it makes sense. Investing more after it's stabilized, or at least after it's like healthy and like it's going, it's working, it's a TBD situation. Unless your product has grown enough where, again, you can invest even more in marketing to, again, attract more buyers, more different types of people. But those marketing and product are so intricately linked, they literally can't do more without each other. It's like marketing can't do more without product growing, but products can't grow unless marketing works, like unless like you're actually acquiring customers. No, but to be fair though, it's not, I think it's a different type of weight. I think marketing does depend more on product than product depends on marketing, if that makes any sense, because marketing alone is not actually not the thing that gets people to buy. It's also pricing. It's also activation. And it's also, you know, inherently product. If product is not, you can't put lipstick on a pig is like a really common saying in our industry. And I think that's extremely true. But I will say, though, that, you know, the two are very intricately linked. the center of the universe for a SaaS company is going to be product at the end of the day, in my opinion. There are some companies, though, that have certainly become successful, product not being the center of the universe, and maybe more like sales being the center of the universe. And then for like engineering products, engineering is actually the center of the universe. But most, I think, PLG SaaS businesses, product is going to be the center of the universe, or at least it should be. But yeah, that's the way that I see it, at least. Those are the top three reasons why overinvesting in marketing doesn't work based on those rules. Market doesn't move as fast as you do. You only have so many people that you can sell to. So TAM, SAM, and SOM. And then finally, all channels have diminishing returns. So that's why doing more and more and more doesn't necessarily make sense. Mm. But it's also why you've got to look at other levers, because it's not just all going to come from marketing. It can't. It actually physically can't come from all marketing.
Right. But don't blame marketing.
All the marketers out there are like, yeah, that's right.
I feel seen.
Yeah. All the product people out there are like, oh my God, like if we hear one more marketing person tell us this. But no, I think it's a point of pride, though. I think it's a, like, to me, the most successful companies are where product is kind of the center of the universe. I say that not to say that like everyone should listen to product, or like it's, you know, it's really product's job. It's really more like, at the end of the day, like the mechanism of value delivery in a SaaS company is going to be product. Right. It's why people come, and it's why people stay, and it's why people leave. Although I say it could, you know, it's product, but it could, all, you know, people leave for a lot of other reasons as well. However, that is, so when I say it's the center of the universe, I really mean like it is ultimately like the fundamental, like it's the foundational core of how the business exists. And everything does have to work together and around it to support it. The vice versa, however, is also true. If product is not strong, then it doesn't matter what levers you pull. It's lipstick on a pig. And if people don't want the pig, not going to buy it. People don't want to go on your cruise ship, they're not going to go on your cruise ship if you don't have an awesome experience on your cruise ship. So like, have an awesome cruise. have an incredible cruise ship.
Right.
But yeah, like, of course, all of these things work and depend on each other. But in a PLG SaaS company, at least, like, product is going to be center of the universe. There are certainly products out there, however, that would not agree, like, wouldn't feel that way. Like, they wouldn't resonate with that. They'd be like, we're not the center of the universe. We're order takers. And it's really sales that is the center of the universe, or whatever. And yeah, like, I think certainly there are exceptions to the rule. There always will be, and there always are. But we try to make it so that the value, like, delivery mechanism primarily is product.
Yeah.
That's what we tried. That's what we aspire towards.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. This was great.
Yeah. Thanks again. And listeners out there, yeah, let me know if you have any questions. I'm always curious, whether it's on like a YouTube comment or whether it's social. You know, we try to distribute wherever we can. But thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.